welcome to a very special edition of the Fremantle Press podcast called Love to Read Local Radio. Love to Read Local is a celebration that takes place from May to June. It's a statewide initiative to showcase Western Australia's many, many wonderful writers and illustrators and the books that we create. My name is Madeleine Dickey. I'm an author, a surfer, and I live in Exmouth, which is part of the Nullie Native Title area in northwest WA. My first novel, Tropo, won the City of Fremantle Tag Hungerford Award, and it's set at a surf resort in Sumatra, Indonesia, where there's simmering tension between the Australian expats and the local Muslim community. It's a story jam-packed with black magic, nasi goreng, and big waves. My second novel, Red Can Origami, came out with Fremantle Press last year, and it's about a conflict between a native title group and a Japanese-owned uranium mining company. The action in Red Can sweeps from the rodeos and fishing holes of northern Australia to the dazzling streets of nighttime Tokyo. At the moment, I'm also working on a new book, and that's the biography of the Kimberley Aboriginal leader, Wayne Bergman. Wayne's a Niigata man, and over several consecutive years, he was named by the Weekend West as one of the most influential Aboriginal people in the state. He was CEO of the Kimberley Land Council during the controversial James Price Point gas negotiations, and he approached me to write this book out of a desire to set the public record straight. I think that's definitely one element of the story, but as I'm going deeper into my research and starting to put the story down on paper, I'm also realising that the story is much bigger than just Wayne. I'm starting to look at how Niigata people fiercely defended their land against the first wave of settlers. I've been reading about the frightening Swedish grave robber Moberg, who stole Aboriginal skeletons, and also hearing stories about the old people, the artists who Wayne worked with in Fitzroy Crossing when he was a young trainee arts coordinator at Munkajub. So that's the project that I'm working on at the moment, and I've got some support from both Regional Arts WA and a Neil Miss Sydney Travelling Scholarship. But that's enough about me. Today I'm joined by two other wonderful writers from Western Australia. My first guest is a descendant of the Palku people of the Pilbara, and her name is Helen Milroy. I loved Helen's book for children, Wombat, Mudlark and Other Stories. It's magnificent. And it's filled with beautiful, gentle lessons, not just for children, but for adults as well. This one came out with Fremantle Press in 2019. More recently, Backyard Birds was just released a couple of weeks ago through Fremantle Press. It was a Bookseller's Choice feature title and was shortlisted for the Reading Children's Prize. It's already being reprinted. That's amazing. Helen, congratulations.
Thank you.
And its follow-up, Backyard Bugs, will be released in 2021. Meanwhile, Willy Willy Wagtail with Margabulla Books is one of the three bush mob tales out in 2020. And the bush mob are a group of animals that work together to solve problems. But Helen, before you became a writer and illustrator, you were a doctor and psychiatrist. What was your path to becoming a writer? Can you tell us a little bit more about that journey?
Sure. Thank you. And hello, everyone. I've always been fascinated by stories. I've grown up with storytelling coming from an Indigenous background. You're really embedded within story right from the beginning of life, and that continues throughout, even as an adult. I still love hearing stories, and particularly the way that Indigenous people tell stories. I think it's quite a unique skill and quite a unique way of understanding the world and your place in the world. So it's always been very much part of who I am. But I guess as you go through school and you get, your career path gets identified and you start going along that journey, you put all of that to one side. I think why I sort of started writing stories was because I had seen so many children and families, I'd seen so many children struggle. And what I wanted to be able to do was highlight the strengths and the positive aspects of children through animals and through Indigenous storytelling. And so I started writing the stories that are in Wombat, Mudlark and Other Stories. I actually wrote them quite some years ago, but I didn't actually have the courage to send them to a publisher. So it took quite a long time, I think, to build up that sort of confidence in saying, well, you know, let's have a go and see if we can get this published. So it was a bit of a long-winded journey, but I feel like I've made it now, and I'm very happy that I've sort of started to publish and get the stories out there, because I love them and I'm hoping other people will enjoy them as much as I do.
Are you writing full-time at the moment?
No, I still work full-time. I'm still a child psychiatrist. I still work full-time. I'm on some other national groups and things like that. But I find, and prior to the COVID pandemic, I spent a lot of time in plane, and I found that that actually gave me a creative space, funnily enough. So I started doing some of my writing and illustrating while in transit, because you can only do so much work on planes, and then you have to allow your brain to do something else for a while.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Well, I'm so happy to be chatting to you today, Helen. My second guest is Brenton E. McKenna. He's a Yaru artist and writer who fell in love with comic books at a young age. He studied visual art for 2 years at Golden TAFE, and in 2009 was one of 20 successful applicants to be awarded a highly sought-after mentorship with the Australian Society of Authors. Brenton's attended several art workshops and residencies, and in doing so, he's generated a lot of national interest. The Ubbies Underdog series is over 200 pages of wonderfully vibrant illustrations and stories set in Broome. Brenton, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your journey, and this series?
Yeah, no worries. How you going, Madeline?
Hi. Hi.
Best way to put Ubbies Underdog is just all the kind of ghost stories I grew up with as a kid, you know, that's and I kind of melted them all together into one big story that evolved around a group of kids who sort of, kind of reflect, I guess, the local identities here, you know. And they're all sort of inspired by characters from that I know personally, from family members and just sort of characters around Broome that I grew up with. It's a graphic novel, so just another way of saying it's a comic book. You know, that's basically how I learned how to read. Like I had a lot of trouble reading and writing as a kid, but you know, the comic books, however, sort of helped me. I basically couldn't read, so just reading just comic books, you know, just looking at the pictures and, you know, bit by bit learning the story about that, and then picking up characters' names and stuff like that. And then, you know, by the time I was 12, I could, you know, read a book on my own kind of thing, and just fell madly in love with comics. And so I've just been doing that throughout my whole teens, my whole early adulthood, and that's what kind of led me down this journey of writing these three graphic novels, yeah.
Oh, I'd love to have a chat to you about your inspirations in a little bit, but I just wanted to let our listeners know I was really lucky to work with Brenton around the launch of Heroes Beginnings, which is the second book in the series, because I was doing some work at Mugabala at the time. And I have to say, Brenton, I really love working with you, and I really love the Ubbies series. I was really enchanted by the way that you kind of redream and reimagine Broome. I've got the Pindan, the depictions of old Chinatown, which, like you said, is kind of a bit spooky and built on ghost stories, the old Perlers cottages. I guess for people who are not familiar with Ubbies world, can you fill us in a bit about what is Ubbies world? What does it look like?
What does it look like? It's basically like a lot of the, you know, towns up the northwest is old, dusty, red, you know, pretty barren looking on the outside, you know, and especially back then. So the Ubbies world kind of, it's set just after World War II, so still kind of recovering from a lot of stuff, a lot of racial tension, a lot of I think racial tension was the big one. But it was almost like a Wild West sort of town, you know, like there wasn't that much, it's almost lawless, you know. And growing up, listening, so the main character Ubbies actually inspired directly by my nan. You know, my nan, like a lot of nans up north, you know, that she was just loud and really tough, and she had 13 brothers and sisters, and I kind of grew up with all these stories about my nan. Basically the best ghost stories I heard, best fighting stories I heard were from my nan's generation. You know, my nan, and she had 13 brothers and sisters, and they were always getting into fights or, you know, telling me all these really cool sort of campfire ghost stories and stuff. That was always from that generation. So I kind of took all these stories and tried to melt it into this sort of fictional world of Ubbies. So even though it's not, it's a fictional story, a lot of the mannerisms, a lot of the language, a lot of the fashion, a lot of the style from that era, I've tried to capture as best I could in comic book form. But basically it's kind of like Broome now, but Broome 50 years ago, even before, you know, it was a bit of a Wild West town.
I love it how that Ubby, who's the main character of the series, is this really brave, smart girl. Like, it's wonderful to have a comic book hero who's a chick, and that's something I think that's really special about the series as well.
Yeah.
On a on a process level, I guess when I was working on Tropo and Red Can in the Kimberley, something that I found really challenging was writing through the wet season. Because as you know, it gets ridiculously hot. And a couple of the places I lived didn't have air conditioning. So it was sort of structuring my writing days. So I was working really early in the morning. But sometimes like whole manuscripts would just go limp with humidity or, you know, writing and the paper would tear. As a visual artist, how did you kind of manage that, like working in the climate?
Yeah, it's funny story because a lot of the artwork I handed in had like, you know, there's occasional, so that because I do the thumbnails first, then the penciling and then the inking and then the sort of the digital colouring is done on the Cintiq. But especially during the inking stage, like the, you know, Rachel Bensalo or Rachel Christensen who were looking at the artwork was going, I don't know if you know, there's a drop of blood here, there's a big smudge here. Can you do this again to you? And there was just like sweat drops and, you know, sometimes I don't, a nosebleeds and the occasional tear. So it was all kind of caught in the artwork and then I'd have to go on to Photoshop and fix it up again. But yeah, it's almost, it was strange. I worked better in the humidity, but it wasn't so kind to my artwork. But I try to in a climate, like from a controlled room with air cons and everything, and which was actually better for my Cintiq. I struggled kind of. I had to find like every half an hour I'd have to step outside the room and just try and warm up a little bit. And then, so it was just this broken routine. So I think it was almost like the book wanted me to sweat it out as I was making it. Yeah.
Wow. So Helen, you're a descendant of the Palkru people, but you grew up in Perth. So I wonder how your relationship to and distance from country plays out in your story.
Well, I guess your culture is with you wherever you are, but there's no doubt that when you go back to country, it's so uplifting and so enriching. In fact, when you stand on the land where your ancestors have been for many thousands of years, many, many generations, it's awesome. And it gives you a profound sense of connection. So I think that part of being Indigenous and part of understanding the connection to culture and country allows you to then in your writing and your storytelling to try and give that feeling to children. So from my perspective, being able to embed children in that ecological framework where they're connected to land, to each other, to nature, to the universe, that's the important part of it. But just that sense of broader connection that all of the relationships are there. Not just with people, but with the earth, with the land, with the animals, all around you. And I think that's what is just such a wonderful part of Indigenous storytelling as well.
Yeah, and I think that connection to nature and to the broader universe as well is something that comes across so strongly in that beautiful story in Wombat Mudluck and other stories about the angry sun. Can you tell us a bit about that story?
Well, most of these stories in that particular book are based on children that I know. They're sort of like personality. And what I found working as a clinician for many years is that children get very negatively labelled, and that's not very nice for kids to have a negative view of themselves. And so part of writing the stories was to highlight the really big positive attributes that kids have. And in the Mudluck and Wombat story, and in the Mudluck story in particular, you know, the little mudlark is one of those kids that just has that emotional intelligence. They're just sort of born with it. And so they're our natural helpers and analysts. And so the little mudlark, you know, finds her way to help the sun and doesn't give up on him and understands his emotions and is able to help him overcome his grief. So I think it is what kids actually can do, but we don't often give them the opportunity to express their talents in the right way. We often see it as a problem rather than turning it around and seeing it as an asset. For example, the little mudlark is very determined, as she is in the story, to help the sun, and she doesn't give up. And I think sometimes we see the determination in children as a bad thing, but in fact in this story it's a really positive thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder as well, how do you integrate the past into your stories for kids?
The past.
Like history. Is there a sense of drawing on kind of older, deeper stories when you're working?
I guess your life is built on stories. I kind of grew up with stories and the idea that the past and the present and the future are not linear, that they're sort of all present and they're sort of an omnipresence of everything together. And I suppose that's how I see it, is that when you're telling stories and say a story like The Mudluck and the Sun, it's timeless. It's not set in any time period. They're timeless. And that's what I love about that type of storytelling. There's a timelessness about it. And so it's relevant to everyone and at any time.
Yeah. I guess in the work that I'm doing at the moment as well, I'm kind of delving quite deep into Australian or Kimberley history, and I guess I'm getting the sense that our history gives us a real frame for our contemporary stories as well.
It does. Yeah. However, what I didn't want to do was bring some of the trauma history into storytelling. I think that's better left in a different way, in a different format. But I think we have to understand the power of stories in healing as well, and in helping people to recover from history.
Brenton, what are your thoughts about that, about the inclusion of sort of history in your work to give that kind of framework for contemporary stories?
That was just similar to what I'm saying, that when I first wrote Ovi's Underdogs, there was actually a lot that I put in it that we kind of left out, but we just tried to navigate around. So, in the Ovi's Underdogs story, like, there's actually no mention of the Stolen Generation. So we're planning on that in future books, but we just sort of initially, the story that I wanted to tell was just about the kind of the fun times and some of the scary times that my Nan's generation kind of had, and what Brim was like at that area. So we tried to focus a lot of that. But there was just so much of it, like, it was so intertwined, there was a lot of those issues of Stolen Generation, it was ingrained into everything. So it was really challenging to sort of write a story that, I was trying to avoid some a lot of that trauma as well, and then B, what I thought was just part of my upbringing compared to someone else, they thought that was quite traumatic, and I was going, no, that was just the way I was brought up, not that traumatizing. But we even had to look at that sort of watering down some of the other issues that that happened just through my generation's childhood. To me, it was just the way we were brought up. But and that's why I kind of had to really learn about my audience and who exactly is going to read graphic novels, but who's going to read a graphic novel about, an Indigenous street fighter from Broome, there were a lot of things that I thought was okay to tell may have come across pretty sensitive. So that was almost like an editing scholarship in itself, I guess, editing the nightmare.
Wow.
Yeah,
it sounds like such a tricky space to navigate.
Yeah.
Really difficult. I know in the final Ubbies you write, what was meant to be a small 50-page comic book 16 years ago became a graphic novel mountain with three peaks. I love that description. But why did it take so long? Was it that sort of heavy editing process in terms of content that was part of it, or what else kind of contributed to such a huge journey?
It was mostly because finding a publisher was probably the hardest part at the start, because I was in Adelaide at this time. I was in Adelaide for about 8 years between 2002 and 2010. In those early years, just trying to find publishers and support, and basically no one wanted to do a graphic novel. They said, no one's going to read a graphic novel. They thought the market in Australia was too small. And there was a lot of things that I knew about graphic novels, but I didn't know much about the sort of the publishing world and vice versa. When I finally met Rachel Christensen from Mugabala, she knew, the publishing world just fine. It was just she didn't know much about graphic novels. So we sort of tried to educate each other, and we sort of stumbled in the dark as I was trying to learn. Trying to learn that world while they were trying to learn mine. And there was a lot of arguments and a lot of pitfalls, and we invested a lot of time in some people, and and it just some of it was worth it, some of it wasn't. It was just hard, mostly because no one had kind of done it before, so we didn't really know the archetypes of success, I guess. And that kind of changed when we had when I got the ASA mentorship, and my mentor Wolfgang Bilsmer came on board, and he was a huge help. But basically, Wolf said, "You got to start from square one. Like, all this stuff you've done, it's just it's just a nightmare to do it. Like, so basically what happened in 2008, by the time I'd finished writing the manuscript and I had all the artwork, when we put everything together, they said, Magabala said it was too big and said, we can't publish this. So, yeah, and hence why they kind of said, you either trim it down and make it smaller or you maybe break it into smaller parts. So, once Wolf came aboard, he said, break it into smaller parts. But it was sort of like, if I break it into smaller parts, I might as well rewrite everything. And that's kind of what we did. We had to just basically rewrite the whole manuscript for a three-part story. And it was mostly like just because no one had done it before, we just made a lot of mistakes. But I've learned from everything. And typically now to do a graphic novel the size of Abby's Underdog should take about anything from 2 to 3 years, not 16, so probably won't make that mistake again, yeah.
Wow. I think, well, I guess with the projects that you've got coming up next, then maybe the process will be a bit quicker.
Yeah, that's exactly. I'm anticipating that for sure. I really hope they're not, 16-year-old projects again. Yeah.
I guess to flip it to Helen, you're already known for the opposite, in a sense, for your speed in writing and creating manuscripts. How long did something like Backyard Bugs take you to write? And I guess what's your writing and illustrating process?
Well, with Backyard Birds and Bugs, and I think the third one might be Creatures, it was just an idea. And I was thinking about, what would be good to be able to illustrate and just a simple little story for kids. And I do absolutely love sitting out in the backyard and watching the birds come. It's an absolute joy for me, and I really do love watching them and seeing what they do and put food out for them and all that sort of thing. So it just came very quickly. And I do love painting and using acrylics on canvas, but of course when you have a very busy life and you travel a lot, you really can't do that. But fortunately, I managed to find a program that I could do the illustrations digitally on the computer, on my iPad. And that's been fantastic. That's been an absolute godsend because I appreciate the blood, sweat and tears that can go into painting a canvas. And, of course, it's much easier to do it on the computer because if you make a mistake, you can just erase it straight away and you don't even have to wait for the paint to dry. So it makes it very, very quick. And I think that for me as well, it's very therapeutic to get into that headspace. When you work with quite difficult topics like mental health and certainly mental health for children, you need time away from that world. And so to escape into a world of illustration and storytelling and animals and creativity, it's very therapeutic. And so you just get
really soothing.
It's very soothing. It's a wonderful thing. And it's one of the things that I think kept me somewhat resilient over the years, is being able to escape into that creative world.
Oh, that's amazing. I think in terms of my own process, I've been in the privileged position to be able to write full-time from about August last year. And for me, the key is really having that time and that financial support just to be able to write. When I've been trying to juggle my writing with other jobs, I don't tend to do either very well. So being able to have that full-time focus has been incredible. And I think on top of that, but having emotional support is really important too. So I've got my husband, Tom, my mum and my sister are really important for this. And so every time I get a knockback or miss out on funding or don't get a residency or, get a terrible review on Goodreads, they're the ones that I sort of ring up and kind of whinge to. And I think it can be a bit difficult, I guess, looking at Facebook or Instagram, and it might seem like you're just going from success to success. But I think the reality is that we don't often share these kind of blows and setbacks and, the things that are kind of tricky for us, or at least I don't feel comfortable kind of sharing the rejections. So I'm interested to hear what kind of support, I guess, both of you have access to. Maybe Helen, you first. What kind of emotional support do you need for your work?
Yeah. Look, I think what the difference for me was, I never really particularly cared if an academic manuscript got knocked back, but when it's storytelling and it's stories that you feel passionate about, they feel part of you. And so it's very personal when you're writing stories and you're illustrating. It's really part of you that goes into the manuscript and even into the paintings. It's like this creative process just comes out of you in a way that gives you a very personal connection to the work that you're doing. So I think when you get knocked back on that more personal work, it feels like it's a personal setback, if you know what I mean. So I think you're right. I think the emotional fallout from that is probably greater than in other areas of work that I do. I've got a lot of emotional support. I have a fantastic partner who just supports me to in any way he possibly can. I've still got my mum. She's 92. She's a storyteller herself, and she has got books published. And she has been an amazing role model and inspiration throughout my entire life. I've got wonderful daughters, and I've got a fantastic little Pomeranian dog who keeps me very happy. But I think that having that privileged space, like you talked about, being able to actually dedicate full-time effort is a real privilege. And I really envy you for being able to do that. That's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. What about yourself, Brenton? I know you've got amazing support from your family as well. They've been really kind of pivotal for you on such a long journey.
Yeah. They were. They have been recently, for a long time. It was kind of just telling them they had no idea what I was doing, you know, which is kind of strange because growing up, you know, like we're pretty laid back and, you know, we tend to sort of, I was never 100% into a lot of the stuff I did growing up, which was really odd because comic books I absolutely loved, you know, and, you know, when I started back in 2002 looking for publishers, like I was going through all the phone books and it was really odd because every time I get knocked back, I did wear it on the chin and, you know, I'd have a few tears and stuff like because it was quite personal, you know, and then it just got to the point where I was kind of getting used to it because I was kind of job hunting at the same time. And I think it was that the fact I was getting knocked back from jobs and knocked back from publishers, they kind of bounced off each other and it sort of felt like at one point getting knocked back from a publisher was just like getting knocked back from a job. And so I was kind of getting immune to it pretty quickly. And I virtually asked everyone I could, publishers, newspapers and the small sort of comic publishers on the East Coast anyway. And to the point I just kept doing it until, you know, I almost anticipated them saying no, but just trying to get their idea of what they thought about graphic novels. And Mugabola was literally the last one. But I kind of like feared their rejection the most because they were from my hometown. And I thought, if I get knocked back from a big publisher, that's no big deal. But if I get knocked back from the little one from my own hometown, then I was going to wear that worse, you know. And so,
Thank goodness they didn't knock you back.
So they didn't. So luckily, I kind of, you know, that whole story where I walked in. That I know you're going to say no, but I just wanted to get your feedback. And I think it's Susie Hazelhurst, and she kind of looked at me and said, no, we don't know what a graphic novel is, but we're going to give you a shot anyway. And I kind of, you know, it was a whole new direction. So, and there were plenty of times where I wanted to quit. You know, I had my first daughter in 2003, and, you know, I was just kind of, I was a bouncer in the nightclub at the time. So I was sort of, whatever waking hour I could, I just spent working on this book. And, it was once I kind of knew how precious time was, I kind of stopped procrastinating like I did a lot in my teens and really knuckled down and made it a routine. And a lot of good things happened, but the knock, like now as of today, I still get knocked back from a lot of stuff, and I just ran on the chin, try to learn something from every loss, and it makes for a better story next time.
I think you're right though when you talk about it being a bit like getting knocked back from jobs, even if it's a funding submission or this or that. It's almost like we as writers and illustrators have to sort of going for like 10 jobs or more a year and then copying that constant. It sort of doesn't stop. It's not kind of like we settle into our job and then that's our job for the next 5 years. It's constant sort of putting yourself out there. So I think it can be kind of wearying, and I don't know, maybe you just need to have a really strong ego or a really strong sense of yourself.
Yeah, I did feel like there was plenty of times where I said, I'm not doing this, this isn't working anymore, and no one reads graphic novels, and even the comic community in Adelaide was saying, we like your comic, but why does it have to be an Indigenous girl? Like, who's going to read? And they just had nothing positive to say. And I said, that's it. I've had enough of this book. And I remember a few times putting it in this giant tub and just shoving it in the shed. And then, like, almost like not an addiction, but, you know, about a day later, I was like, I got to go back in there, grab my stuff out. And I just keep working. I try to work on other comic ideas and stuff like that. But Arby's was the only one where I kind of felt like Nan was watching me a lot as well. My Nan had passed away by then, and a bit of it was guilt saying that, oh, this is not what my Nan wanted and she didn't want me to quit on this. So I kind of kept persevering, mostly because of that. And once the first one came out, that's when my family kind of got on board and, oh, this is what you're doing. And it's like, yeah, this, you know, those comics I read throughout my whole my whole childhood, I'm making my own comic. And since then, they've been fantastic. Family's been awesome. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, we might perhaps move on to some of our local WA book recommendations. So I guess as we all know, the COVID-19 outbreak has been pretty tough on the arts community. It's affected authors. I'm not sure about you two, but certainly I've had a heap of events cancelled, lost quite a lot of money. Yeah. And it's also been hard on booksellers with a drop in business. But I know that a lot of local booksellers have really taken up this challenge and they're launching things like free home delivery. They're encouraging us to read local as well as to support local authors. So I guess with all of this in mind, I was hoping that both of you could recommend a few titles for us to read while we're hunkered down this autumn and maybe winter. I'd love to hear about any books by West Australian authors that you've been reading or have been sort of go-to text or mainstays for each of you. Helen, would you like to give us some good recommendations?
Yeah, thank you. Look, like Brenton, I actually grew up on comics as well. And even though I've obviously gone through a lot of education and have to read a lot of stuff for work, I'm a really slow reader. And so I see myself more as a visual reader than a language reader. And so I really love books that have illustrations. That's my go-to always, is books that have amazing illustrations. And I have to say, one of the author illustrators that I've admired for many years is Sean Tan. I think some of his books and illustrations are just absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
And you can look at one of the pictures and it tells the whole story without even any words on the page. And I think that's what I love about really good illustrating, is that it tells the story for you and probably in a deeper way than if you read the words. Mm-hmm. So I actually just ordered one of his latest books called Tales from the Inner City, because it's about animals and our relationship with animals, which is very, very dear to my heart. And I would actually recommend any of his sort of story books. He actually says that in one of his interviews, he says that one of the most commonly asked questions is, you know, who are your books for? And he basically says, for anyone who wants to have a look at them. And I think that's what I love also about his work, is that it's not just for kids. I think those picture books tell a story for adults as well. And so I agree with you, Brenton. You might have asked the question, you know, who's going to read a graphic novel? Well, I would.
I
would, because I think the visual stuff is just as important as the words. In fact, I probably can probably imagine more from the image than I do from the words. So definitely Sean Tan. I also really like the WADA, I'm not sure quite how you say that, the WADA series that Fremantle Press produced, which were the readers for kids. I think they're a fantastic way to get kids into reading and also into, for other kids as well who aren't Indigenous, to have some Indigenous stories to read, because this is part of their heritage growing up in Australia, of course. So I like that whole series of books. They're only small, but I think they're great for kids to read. And another person who does fantastic graphic illustrations, I think, or graphic novels for kids is James Foley. And I loved his robot idea, because I thought the idea of being able to design a robot as a brother was fantastic. I grew up with two brothers. And then the idea of being able to design my own brother would have been great when I was I just think, and then his way of engaging and the topics that he comes up with and the way he engages in his stories is fantastic to read.
Yeah, I really like that point as well about having stories that anybody wants to read, not just being specific for kids. And I guess to come back to your book, Wombat Mudlark and other stories, I really felt that reading that book. Like, it's not just a book for kids. It can be a book for adults with some beautiful lessons in there as well.
That's what I was just going to say. I think when I wrote it, I did read it with kids in mind, but in actual fact, I've presented it a few times for adult audiences and they identify with it just as much as kids do. So,
Absolutely. What about yourself, Brenton? What are a couple of WA authors who you would recommend?
Oh, yeah, I'm glad you brought up Sean Tan. He actually gave me some really good advice. So in regards to some of the along those lines, he basically said, just tell the story and hopefully the story picks its own audience, which we kind of stuck to that religiously in Mugabala. And luckily, that's kind of what's happened. So Abby's has kind of found her following, mostly on the East Coast. And as of last year, we finally got a lot of interest over in the US as well. So that's been kind of cool. So I'm glad I kind of stuck to my guns on that. So I've got to kind of thank Chuantan enough for that. And I was lucky enough with the mentorship to have my mentor as Wolfgang Bilsma. So a lot of people who don't know him, Wolfgang's actually the chief and editor of a graphic novel publishing company called Gestalt, which are from Perth. I think they're doing incredible stuff. I'd highly recommend anything done by Gestalt. I've got three titles here. I also just want to quickly shout out to James Foley too. He's a really good friend and I love him. I think he's a great, he just comes up with genius stuff. The Last Viking, you know, I think is absolutely brilliant. I just wanted to have a quick shout out to him. The titles I'm looking at, they're Gestalt titles, graphic novels. The first one that I kind of read as a part of my mentorship, not as part of my mentorship, but the first Gestalt I read was one called The Eldritch Kid, Whiskey and Hate. It's a graphic novel. It's almost like a take. It's written by Christian Reed, who's actually a cool friend, and Michael Mayer, who is the illustrator, and it's kind of like a the Lone Ranger and Tonto. It's basically, you know, the Lone Ranger with his sort of Native American sidekick, but it's a flip, whereas the Native American sidekick's actually an Oxford scholar and he's quite educated, and the Eldritch Kid is actually a murderous Viking, you know. So it's kind of got this really, it's basically like a horror western, which is it's a great little title. The second one by another fantastic creator, this guy, I'm sure he's going to be big in Hollywood one day. It's Justin Randall, who's one of Gestalt's other creators. And he's the author and illustrator of a graphic novel called Changing Ways, which a lot of Walking Dead fans have said is the next big thing, that they're quite sure that they're going to make a TV show of this.
Isn't it Justin,
kind of like, it's really surreal stuff. It's almost like, people are looking forward to a zombie apocalypse, and I don't know when that happened, but it's like, yeah, I'm looking forward to killing these really slow zombies. But Justin's Changing Ways is almost like the zombies that think and outsmart you, and I think it's the next level up. So I think he's got a big fan base as well. He's also, I think, a lecturer at one of the unis, and he's an absolute whiz. If you look at his artwork, he's an absolute whiz on Photoshop. He's actually the guy that I'll ask Wolf, and then Wolf will ask him for his advice for any sort of Photoshop tips and stuff like that. So he's a brilliant creator, and his titles, I think Justin's most famous for is Changing Ways. The last one, last title is called The Deep, written by Tom Taylor, and I think it's illustrated by, I think, James Brower. I can never say that properly, but I think it's James Brower, the illustrator. And I don't know if you guys know, Tom Taylor's actually, he works for DC Comics over in the US. And he just released an Aboriginal kid. The latest member to join the DC's Suicide Squad is an Indigenous girl by the name of Thylacine, who's actually from the Pilbara. That's only just come about, I think, about a month ago, they debuted the character. So the latest Suicide Squad character is an Indigenous girl from the Pilbara. So Tom's from Melbourne traditionally, but I think everyone's catching on that, you know, female Indigenous street fighters are the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I've just been Googling while you've been talking.
Oh, okay.
so many good recommendations there.
Yeah. Anything with the Gestalt stamp on it, I'm a big fan of. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a couple of recommendations close to home back in WA. First off, a children's picture book called The Children from Rawa Monster Party. Not sure if either of you guys saw that one. It came out with Mugabala Books last year. Basically, it starts and it's after sunset, and a group of Technicolor monsters are on the move. So they steal food from the local shop, they stuff their faces with cake, they jump up and down on the community phone box and squash it, and that's just the start. It's this joyous and kind of vivid romp that follows the monsters as they just let loose on the community.
And it's not really your average children's book. It was created at Punmu, which is a community on Marshy Country in the Pilbara's Great Sandy Desert. And I think two celebrated kids' books authors, Alison Lester and Jane Godwin, travelled out to the community, and it was part of a project to help improve literacy. So the monsters came out of the imaginations of the middle primary children at Punmu's Rawa Community School. And, yeah, they act out stories, both real and imagined. I thought that book was a real treat. I really enjoyed that one. I'm also reading a lot of history at the moment for Wayne's biography. So a lot of the books I'm reading are pretty tricky to get a hold of. But one that I'm reading at the moment is a Fremantle Press publication by Ian Crawford called We Won the Victory. And Ian worked really closely with mob in Colombo and Derby to record a history of the North Kimberley coast. And there's one incredible story in this book, which I read a couple of days ago, which touches on the pearling history in Broome, which is kind of a part of the Ubbies books as well. And the story's about a Warrawa man from the Woolagoodja family, and he worked on the pearl luggers in the 20s and 30s. And in 1935, he was on a lugger of Japanese crew and pearl divers just off 80 Mile Beach. And then he saw on the boat the barometer plummeted and these huge black clouds of a cyclone came rolling in. And the crew basically just said, well, there's nothing we can do. We may as well just drink sake and die happy. And the Warrawa man said, no, I'm not ready to die yet. And so he closed the hatches on the crew and he turned the lugger toward the sea. And for a day and a half, or maybe even 2 days, he single-handedly steered this lugger through the cyclone. And after 2 days, he was exhausted. He was almost asleep on his feet. And they'd found themselves blown north into Beagle Bay, so they were safe. But when he opened up the hatch, he found this mess of vomit and empty sake bottles, and all the crew were passed out and those ones that were still awake or conscious were still drinking. And basically this cyclone was so big that 21 luggers were lost and 140 men drowned. And this man was able to steer them to safety. It's just such a marvellous story. And I feel
those stories, really paint the Kimberley,
Don't they paint the Kimberley? And just really spine-tingling. And especially there's a lot of stories about Aboriginal heroes in this book, and it's not something that we hear a lot about, you know, in our mainstream sort of society, but the stories are there.
I think that's right, Madeline, and I think that there's an enormous number now of really personal histories or biographies of Aboriginal people in Western Australia, and they're all worth reading. They're all amazing stories of resilience and survival, and I think they're all worth reading because they paint a very different picture for us of our history.
I really think so as well. Another book, which I won't go into too much detail about, but one that is a mainstay for me, I've gone back and back to this over the years, is the Rupa Rupa book, Stories from the Fitzroy River Drovers. And that's a Mugabulla publication. I think it's in its second edition now. And I think for anybody out there with an interest in the pastoral industry or who's interested to learn about what sort of contributions Aboriginal people made in the pastoral industry, that's a series of oral stories. And it is, it's spine tingling. You read it and you just get such a sense of, what sort of really happened, because the diaries of the white fellas that I'm reading at the moment paint a really different story. And I think it's important that all of, you know, all of our voices are sort of heard.
Absolutely.
So before we wrap it up, do you guys have anything else you'd like to share with our listeners or any sort of closing thoughts about writing in WA?
I just think stories are good for everybody, and you're never too old to hear a story. And if you think about your own life and you think about what you learned at school, you probably remember it all in stories. So I just think it's fundamental to our existence, and we sometimes forget how important it is. We get caught up with technology and gaming and all these other sorts of things. But actually one of the things we need most is stories.
That's so true. I feel like we waste so much time on that endless scroll.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think you know, every time I go to do a workshop somewhere, I always try to get my hands on like local ghost stories and just something or something that sort of, you know, what is it that kids talk around the campfire, you know, those kind of stories. And every town's got one. And I was really scared at one point thinking, well, with the rise of technology and video games and VRs and iPhones, are those days gone? And luckily they're not, you know. As far as I know, both the Pilbara, you know, the Gascoyne, like, you know, all these places I've kind of done, even, you know, you know, West End, East Kimberley, you know, kids still love telling stories around a campfire that never gets really old. And I was really satisfied to know, oh, yeah, so I think as humans, we still will never grow out of that, I think, as far as sitting around a campfire and telling stories. You know, that's what Mum loved and that's what I love doing. And I think I just want to say, you know, graphic novels, the one thing I've run to a lot, it's just a lot of resistance that even with some of the schools I've done, you know, I can often cut the faculty in half, you know, where some teachers think, oh, this is awesome, this is what I grew up with, yeah, it's really works, and then there'll be, you know, the other side that kind of says, oh, you know, they call it Pulp Fiction and, you know, it rots kids' brains. Like, there's still, unfortunately, a few thinkers like that out there, and I just want to say it's absolutely untrue. If you have a reluctant reader, you know, I think the visual literacy, you know, graphic novels, heavily illustrated textbooks, whatever, it still matters, you know, still works.
Absolutely agree. I think stories are in our DNA.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good way to put it, yeah.
Well, that's a really hopeful note to read on. I think that definitely warms my heart to think that, yep, our stories are not going to get old. It's been so lovely to catch up with you both today. So nice to connect with our listeners and readers out there. Today we've sort of touched on representations of country in our work, our processes, the way history shapes what we write, and the importance of our families in giving us support.
Yeah.
If you'd like to purchase either Helen or Brenton's books, you can head to the Fremantle Press and Mugabulla Books website or to your local favourite bookshop online or in person. Helen and Brenton, thanks so much for your time today, and a big thank you to our listeners for being a part of Love to Read Local Radio. Love to Read Local Radio is brought to you by Fremantle Press with support from the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund. Love to Read Local is a celebration of Western Australia's numerous outstanding writers and illustrators and our work. It's brought to you by Writing WA, and you can check the show notes for more details about Writing WA as well as information or if you're keen to get hold of any of the books that we've talked about today. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to the Fremantle Press podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, SoundCloud, or anywhere you get your favourite podcast from. This is Madeleine Dickey signing off on Love to Read Local Radio.